I won't take a reading. The one verse of Scripture that came to my mind was that little verse in the first chapter of the Gospel of John. There was a man sent from God. And certainly that describes this amazing person who is surprisingly very, very little known. A month or two ago, I had the opportunity of making a journey to the little village of Llangeitho. Now, I'm afraid my Welsh is non-existent, so my pronunciations are a wild guess, but I should think that none of you are any better placed than me to say what it should be, so I call this Llangeitho. It's a tiny village between Aberaeron on the coast and Tregaron, about 8 to 10 miles inland. Lovely part of the country, not the wild mountainous Wales, but hilly and delightful, really. And this is a little village about the size of Wildmoor or Fairfield, I suppose. We drove in looking for somebody, looking for the place where Daniel Rowlands preached and was buried. We saw a large chapel, we saw a statue, and it had the name Daniel Rowlands. There was nobody about, the chapel was shut, there was no notice, nothing to tell us anything about him. We searched the graveyard, there was no grave. But down across the fields and on the other side of the little river, which flows out at Aberaeron, was the old Church of England, now Church of Wales. So we went there and we couldn't find his grave either. But there were two ladies doing the flowers, and we asked them, was Daniel Rowlands buried there? And they took us into the church, and roughly in this sort of position where the baptistry is, they rolled back the mat, and there was the slab marking the burial place of Daniel Rowlands. Forgotten now, I don't suppose many people in that part would have any idea who he was. Yet to many in his day, he was the greatest minister of the gospel in the world since the apostles. Now that sounds an exaggeration, and obviously it's the kind of statement that could possibly be applied to several people. Thomas Charles of Barla, his successor among the Calvinistic Methodists, said that the history of the labours of that extraordinary man Daniel Rowlands, had it been written, would scarcely have found a parallel in the annals of biography. There are no doubt thousands, indeed tens of thousands, now in heaven who acknowledge him as their Father in Christ. That's the kind of person we're talking about. Almost unknown today, in his day a gigantic figure, yet known in Wales because, as Paul said, he was a Welshman who preached in Welsh and left nothing behind him in the way of books or anything like that. Now, we think of Wales as a land of chapels and religion and revival, and we tend to think of the 1904 revival or the 1859 revival. We have to go back before that happened, to a time when there were no chapels in Wales, or hardly any nonconformity of any kind. The Church of England ruled. It was a time of tremendous darkness in the 12 counties that made up the principality. Darkness of ignorance, darkness of sin. Bibles were... Bishop Morgan had indeed translated the Bible into Welsh, but they were very expensive and almost non-existent. The preaching of the gospel was almost unknown. It was a very, very dark time. 100 years later, George Borrow, travelling in Wales, wrote his book, and he entitled it Wild Wales. Well, if Wales was wild in George Borrow's time, 100 years earlier, in Daniel Rowland's time, it was indeed a very wild country. Now, the 18th century really was a very, very dark time. If you want to read a couple of chapters on it, in the book by J.C. Ryle on our shelves, The Christian Leaders of the 18th Century, you'll find two chapters on the 18th century, a time when the religion of the Puritans, Matthew Henry, if you remember, died in 1714, and his generation of people were the last of the Puritans. That religion was almost extinct. The terrible legacy left behind by the House of Stuart, Charles I, with his infamous Book of Sports, which Bishop Lord insisted on being read in all the churches, exhorting people to spend the Sabbath afternoon in sports. That had been revived by Charles II, and it left its mark on England. The Sabbath was destroyed. This has always been a weakness with the Church of England, and I read in our papers on Monday, I think it was, the Dean of Chester attending the Sunday races when racing began for the first time in Chester. But this goes back to the time of the Stuarts. The act of uniformity that drove all the godliest of the ministers out of the Church of England, this had left its mark on England. The bishops and the clergy were given to worldliness. The people at large were given to drunkenness, immorality, cruel and pernicious sports, and complete indifference and unbelief. The nonconformists, where they were found, had lost their edge. They were drifting into liberal thinking. Anybody who preached the true gospel was bitterly persecuted, not now by the Catholics, but by what had taken their place, the unbelieving Church of England. And yet the amazing thing is that it was at this time that God chose to visit this land with one of the most wonderful times of revival that has been in our history. And it was in this century that men were raised up. All of a sudden, a whole army of tremendous men, 1703 John Wesley, 1714 George Whitfield, 1716 John Berridge, 1714 Romaine, Grimshaw, 1708, Newton, John Newton, 1725, a tremendous number of others as well, were raised up by God to stem this awful flood of evil. And in Wales, Daniel Rowlands was born, 1713, and he lived till 1790. The condition in Wales was as bad as in England, if not worse. One writer in Barla, a man who was a contemporary, wrote, "The common people were more inclined to go to church on Sabbath mornings than the gentry, but in the afternoons they greedily followed their amusements. There was hardly a Sabbath afternoon on which they had not, in some part of the country, some place for sports. Here the youths exhibited their strength. A great number of people came to look at them. Saturday nights, in the summer especially, the young people, male and female, kept what were called singing nights and amused themselves by singing and dancing till the dawn of the Sabbath. In Barla, on the Sabbath afternoons, they were usually singing and dancing in the public houses, playing tennis, and in every corner of the town some sport was going on until nightfall, while the gentry entertained themselves with concerts in the loft of the town hall." This was the Wales in which Daniel Rowlands was born. But God had purposes, and he purposed to show that the power of the gospel was able to overcome this terrible, terrible flood of evil. Three names in Wales particularly spanned the next 100 years. Daniel Rowlands at Llangeitho, Thomas Charles following him at Barla, and John Elias, who spent his life in Anglesey. And revival spread, beginning in South Wales with the itinerating work of Howell Harris, spreading to Mid Wales, where Daniel Rowlands lived, and further north then to Barla and North Wales and Anglesey. And by the end of that 100 years, Wales had been filled with the gospel. It was indeed a wonderful time. Now, what happened? Well, we could go in our imagination to Llangeitho. I can picture easily because it's quite fresh in my mind. But the church service would be over. There was no chapel then. The chapel hadn't been built. The Sunday afternoon sports would have begun. There would have been horse racing, running, wrestling, cockfighting, crowds of spectators, all the young people determined to show who was the best. And then following that, there would be dancing and singing and plentiful drinking, and the day ending in drunkenness and revelry of all sorts. Prominent in this awful desecration of a Sabbath was the last person you would have expected to see. It was the curate who had led the morning service. He was curate in charge of Llangeitho and two neighbouring parishes. He was a young man in his just turned 20. His father had died, and his brother, John, his elder brother John, was the incumbent, but he preferred a life of leisure, so he retired somewhere else to live in peace and paid his younger brother £10 a year to be curate of these three parishes. That morning, Daniel Rowlands had taken the service. What it was, we don't know. Most church services then had little preaching. Prayers were read, a psalm would be sung, and that was enough for priest and people. Possibly it was like that, he may even have preached. But that being over, here he was, leading the revelry. He was a very, very strong young man, medium built, a very fast runner, very quick in his movements, very vivacious and lively, and he had a tremendous following among the young people of Llangeitho. He had been brought up and educated for the ministry by his father, who was the rector, until he died 2 years before. We judge his father had no true faith. It was evident his son was a godless, dissolute young man, and yet he educated him for the ministry and encouraged his brother and he to think of that as their life's work. He had been to Hereford Grammar School. He had excelled as a classical and a Hebrew scholar. He was of a powerful mind. For some reason, he didn't go to university. And after his father's death, probably through poverty, he walked to London and applied for ordination and was given a license to preach as a curate in the Church of England. It does indicate this, that he was prepared to walk over a couple of hundred miles to do this. It shows that the young man was determined, and it also shows that he was very poor. But now he was in his job. Think of the awful system. Think of the guilt attaching to people who led the blind leaders of the blind. Now, God stepped in. He went on like that for some time, confident, full of conceit and pride, until two things happened. He was in charge of three churches, and in one of them, the neighbouring one, he noticed his congregation getting smaller and smaller. Now, that was unusual, because there was nothing challenging in his ministry. People liked that kind of thing, but the people were going, and he asked why. And it turned out that there was a godly dissenting minister at a nearby chapel called Philip Pugh who was preaching the gospel, and the people were going to hear him, and they were being converted. This made him think. The next event made him think even more, because in a neighbouring church at Llandevi Brevi, I think it is. The place is still there, and this was the largest of his three churches. It actually held 3,000 people. A visiting preacher from South Wales had come, a godly converted minister, Griffith Jones, and Rowlands was persuaded to go to listen to him. The church was crowded. Most people had to stand. There weren't seats for them all. And Rowlands took his place right at the front, right in front of the minister. His appearance was very vain, so the writer says, full of conceit and lightness. So large was the number of people there that Rowlands had to take his place right at the front, evidently conceited and full of himself, and his face showing no small measure of contempt. His appearance drew the attention of the preacher as he was preaching. So much so, in fact, that he stopped his sermon and offered publicly a very earnest and affecting prayer for the vain young man that stood before him, beseeching God in a special manner to make him a suitable instrument for turning many from darkness to light. This prayer had an amazing effect. Rowland's face changed. He returned home immediately after the service a different man. His pride had gone. His head and his face were toward the ground. He seemed very thoughtful, and this was the beginning of a work of grace in Daniel Rowland. God had saved a sinner. The change changed his preaching. It appears we have very, very little information. This little booklet is just one of two that were written at the time. Hardly anything is written about him. But it would appear that he did preach, but his preaching began to change. He was 25 years of age. He had been curate for 5 years. But now he began to preach in earnest. What he knew and felt, he spoke. And the account goes something like this. He preached at first the law of God in its high and minute demands and its awful threatenings. He stood, as it were, on Mount Sinai and loudly proclaimed eternal perdition to a sinful world. Awful and extremely terrific was his message. Nothing but the consuming flashes and thunders of the law, with hardly anything to relieve it of the joyfulness of the gospel. Endless judgment, deserved by sinners, was what he set forth with unusual power and energy. His own spirit seems to have been filled with a great and awful terror, and he seemed as if he wished to kindle the fire of hell around the transgressors of God's law, that he might terrify them. He unfolded the indignation of heaven against sin with amazing clearness, earnestness, and vigor. But there was no harshness in his voice, nor sternness in his countenance, but on the contrary, the most melting tenderness. He spoke as one overflowing with compassion and under the deepest conviction of his own unworthiness. And that preaching took effect. It was some time before he entered into the liberty and joy of the gospel himself, but that preaching took effect, and now those churches in which he preached began to be packed, so much so that standing inside was insufficient, and the churchyards around were packed with people numbering thousands coming to hear Daniel Rowland's. And as they heard of God's wrath against sin, they would fall to the ground in terror, often almost unconscious with the weight of God's judgment felt in their consciences. This was nothing like the extravagances you read of in the press and on television today. This was real. This was a godless, hell-deserving land, and the law of God was being put before them. This is perhaps what is needed in our land today. But the effects were wonderful. And even before Rowland's himself enjoyed his gospel, souls were being saved. And this went on and became the beginning of a life of wonderful, effective preaching of the gospel. It wasn't long before the five counties in the vicinity were touched by Daniel Rowland's preaching. He didn't go to them, they came to him. And people would come from far and wide, travelling miles upon miles, to be present on the Sabbath when Daniel Rowland was preaching. A young man in his mid-twenties who felt the power of God's law on his soul and gradually came to enjoy the light of the gospel. Now, what happened in that ministry? Well, his preaching went on at Llangeitho for nearly 50 years. Again, something quite remarkable. But he was primarily a local preacher. In most of his lifetime, he was present on the Sabbath at Llangeitho. He preached in each of those three churches, first in one, and then in the next, and then in the next, all on the same day. The crowds numbered regularly between 4,000 and 5,000. Now, if you go to that place, if you can imagine Fairfield, put in the middle of wide open country, hardly houses anywhere around, and if you can imagine 4,000 to 5,000 people gathering. You can see how amazing this was. And this was something that didn't last a year or 2 years. It lasted 50 years. In fact, it lasted for 25 years after his death. This was God at work. The preaching at first was strictly limited to these three churches. He was a churchman. He knew nothing else. He would never have thought of preaching in a chapel or in the open air. But God began to lead him. He was led first to field preaching or open air preaching in this way. His conscience was touched as he thought of his former companions whom he had led into sin. Since he started preaching, they had moved their sports up into the hills and found a convenient place where they could gather every Sabbath afternoon. They disliked him and his preaching. They never came to church. What could he do? He determined to go and to preach to them. And so one Sabbath afternoon he went up into the hills, and there he found this vast crowd gathered around a cockfight. And they were unaware of his coming, and he pushed his way into the center of it, and he preached to them. What he said I don't know, but the power was such that that was the last time they ever gathered. And for the next 50 years, in fact ever since, there has been no more sports on the Sabbath in that part. From then on, he happily preached wherever he could in the open air. He began also to preach further afield. As a curate, he had no license to preach except in his own parish. But God moved him further afield. It happened in this way. There was a farmer's wife living about 25 miles away in Carmarthen who had a sister in Llangeitho, and she came to visit her sister from time to time, and she came to hear the clergyman. She came next Sunday, and her sister said to her, "What's the matter? Is your husband well, or are your children well?" "Oh, yes," she said, "there's nothing like that wrong." "Well, what is the matter?" "Well, I don't know what is the matter," she said, "but it's something that your crack clergyman," that's what he was known as, "your crack clergyman said last Sunday. It's stayed with me all week and never left me day or night, and I've come to find out." Her journey took her more than 20 miles across the mountains on foot. But she began coming, and she came almost for the rest of her life. When she'd been coming for about 6 months, she went to Daniel Rowlands and she said, "Sir, if what you say to us is true, there are many in my neighbourhood in a dangerous condition going fast to eternal misery. For the sake of their souls, come over and preach to them." "Well," he said, "if you can get permission from your clergyman, I will come." She got permission, and he came. And on that first visit, 30 persons were converted. But something else happened. There was in that parish the squire, a gentleman, who every Sunday used to amuse himself with hunting. He would go out on Sunday morning with some of his tenants, his servants and his dogs, and quite a large retinue. And he'd heard about this stranger coming to preach, and he thought for a bit of fun he'd go and listen himself. So he came into the church and found it packed, and full of pride and insolence and contempt, he came to the front seat and he stood up on the seat in front of Daniel Rowlands and looked at him with contempt and scorn, in endeavouring to intimidate the young preacher. Daniel Rowlands was just about 30 years old. Rowlands saw him, paid no attention, and went on preaching. But in a short time, his words became very powerful, so penetrating and terrific that his hearers stood fixed with amazement and trembling with fear. The appearance of the gentleman soon changed. His face fell, his limbs quaked, the tears streamed down his cheeks, he could no longer stand. He sat down and buried his head in his hands, weeping profusely. This sight awed the congregation. The lion had been tamed. The man stayed like that the whole service, as quiet as he could apart from his sobbing. At the end he went up and begged forgiveness and invited Rowlands back to his house. He went, was entertained, and from that day that man was a converted man and began every Sabbath to go over those 25 miles to become one of Rowlands' regular hearers. And Roland saw that there was needs further afield, and so he began, as occasion permitted, to travel around. He had met Howell Harris, he never got permission to be ordained. The clergy wouldn't have him. He was what they called an exhorter. But he was itinerating in South Wales, and he and Rowlands were converted about the same time. And together they attempted to take the gospel further afield up into North Wales. They met with tremendous opposition and persecution. Harris was nearly murdered in Barla. Daniel Rowlands at Aberystwyth, a man raised a gun and fired at him intending to kill him, but the gun wouldn't go off. On another occasion, gunpowder was placed under the platform where he was to preach, and a train was laid intending to be set off in the middle of his sermon. That was the kind of opposition that came from the clergy and the gentry through the mobs against these early preachers of the gospel. But Daniel Rowland's work had begun. He found like-minded helpers, men like Howell Harris, men like William Williams, the hymn writer, the Charles Wesley of Wales, the man who gave Wales hymn singing, the writer of Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah. He and Rowlands were great friends and worked together. They died within a year of each other. Williams, when he died, or just before, wrote to a young friend. He said, "For nearly 50 years I have travelled 3,000 miles preaching the gospel every year. This was all on pony or on foot." These were the itinerant preachers of that century. As people were converted, a need arose. Howell Harris had begun this in South Wales. What were they to do? The only church was the Church of England. There was nothing in most cases for their souls. They began to gather them into private societies, on the lines, I suppose, of Wesley's societies in England. And these people would be placed under the care of godly men, a few ministers, mainly elders raised up by God, and they met in these societies. And Daniel Rowlands, without realizing it, became a father figure to them all, a leader of them all, and he welded them into the association. They began to be called Methodists because of their insistence on holiness. They were called Calvinistic Methodists to distinguish them from John Wesley's followers, who were Arminians. And so the Calvinistic Methodism of Wales began. They didn't separate from the Church of England until they were driven out. But they met apart from the church services, and together they would pray, exhort one another, preach the gospel, and seek to witness. And once they were knit together into an association, they began the quarterly meetings of the association, and it was inevitable that Daniel Rowlands became, if you like, the moderator, though he wasn't called that, but the person who stood over the whole of that association. And by the end of his life, Calvinistic Methodism had been established in South Wales and Mid Wales and a little into North Wales. But of course, Satan obviously works when God works. And Daniel Rowlands was opposed from the start. The local clergy were bitterly opposed to him, constantly complaining to the Bishop of St. David's, about his irregularities. The irregularities they complained about were not the things that they did, drunkenness, immorality, hunting, shooting, gambling. The irregularity was simply that he preached outside his own parish, and he was brought before the church courts, he was brought before the bishop, he and William Williams, on more than one occasion. And to all the charges, he would simply reply, he had done nothing but with a view to the glory of God in the salvation of sinners. And as God owned his labours by saving souls, he could not stop what he was doing. Well, the result was that the bishop refused, on his father's death, to appoint him to be rector. Instead, he gave him an open insult by appointing his young son, Daniel, as the rector over his father, who had been preaching there for nearly 30 years. It's almost unbelievable, isn't it? That was in 1760. So Daniel Rowlands continued on his £10 a year, but mercifully the son loved his father, so he left him to live in the house that was used as the vicarage, I suppose, and left him free to do the work he had been doing. But the complaints went on, and 3 years later, in 1763, when Daniel Rowlands was 50, as he mounted the pulpit one Sabbath morning, two clergymen entered with a letter. It was a letter from the Bishop of St. David's revoking his license to preach, so that now he would be breaking the law if he preached in the church. He read the letter. He looked up to his congregation, thousands of them. He said, "We must obey the higher powers. Let me beg you to go out quietly, and we will continue the service by the church gate." They went out. There was hardly a person who wasn't weeping, but the service continued. Well, the Lord had a hand in it. His congregation left with him. They built him the chapel that stood on the site where the present chapel stands, on the high ground over the river, looking down on the church. And there, in a building that would seat 800 people, he continued to spend the rest of his life preaching. What was it like at Llangeitho on one of those Sabbath days? Well, it would be something like this. You have to be reminded that you're thinking of a tiny village. But early on the Sabbath morning, you would see coming from every direction individuals, families, groups of people. Most of them were walking distances of over 10 miles, many from between 25 to 30 miles. On some Sundays, they would come 40 to 60 miles, sometimes in groups of 20 or 30 from one village. Some would be on pony, the majority would be on foot. There would be no horses and carriages because these were the poor people. Those on foot often left on Saturday and took short cuts across the mountains, whereas those on pony would go the longer route by the road. And as the morning went on, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, the village would be filled with worshippers. Fields would be filled with rows and rows of ponies all tethered. It would be like a vast fair, except that everybody was quiet and reverend. The congregation would be, as a rule, about 4,000 to 5,000 people. This was the average congregation. These would consist of his local regular congregation of about 3,000 people and visitors who would come from great distances. If I can just give you an example. An old preacher, John Williams of Dollythellan, I think it is. I looked up on the map. It's near Battersea Coed, which is over 80 miles away as the crow flies. Told the writer that he remembered walking all the way from Dollythellan to Llangeitho once. He was so tired after the journey he ought to have gone to bed rather than chapel. But he went to hear Rowlands. His text was Isaiah 25, verse 6. "And in this mountain shall the Lord of hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wine on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of wine on the lees well refined." The old preacher said, "You have never heard such a thing." He began to tap the barrels of the covenant of grace and to let the wine well refined out to the people and to give the people to drink. It flowed all over the chapel. I drank. And there I was, and scores of others, in an ecstasy of delight, praising God, having forgotten all fatigue and bodily wants. That was just one man, and the blessing he found when he came to listen to Daniel Rowlands. But there were many, many who did this. It crops up in people's letters. One man, Peter Jones from North Wales in Flintshire, records how 11 times in his life he made a double journey of 210 miles on foot to be present to hear Daniel Rowlands. A woman, the wife of John somebody, or Flincher, travelled 7 times on pony, over 200 miles a double journey, to hear Daniel Rowlands. And there were many such who every year at some time would endeavour to go to hear Daniel Rowlands. It was as if his ministry was like Joseph in the land of Egypt, when people came for bread for themselves, for their families, for their neighbours. And they would come, and if they could stay long enough, they would listen to 2 or 3 sermons, and they would go back rejoicing, and whole companies would travel back, often filling the valleys and the mountains with their singing, as they rejoiced in the gospel truths they had heard. It was a wonderful time. And this continued, as I said to you earlier, for 50 years. And even 20 years after his death, his son Nathaniel was the minister. It continued, the same numbers. And a writer 100 years later reported a congregation of 1,000 people in that tiny hamlet. You have to remember that Daniel Rowlands didn't move about. Therefore, he couldn't, as Whitfield and Wesley and others could do, repeat his sermons. Every sermon he prepared for, and every sermon was fresh and different. Remember, too, that this wasn't like Spurgeon filling the Metropolitan Tabernacle when he had the population of London all around to draw from with transport of a kind then. These were people who walked or rode on their Welsh ponies. Blessing continued almost unbroken the whole of that time, but there were times of remarkable revival, times when God seemed to come down and which vast numbers were converted at one time. Writers speak of 7 such times. It's difficult to speak about them, but they were times when the power of the gospel was overpowering, but not in the modern way. The effect on people was deep conviction of sin, heart-rending concern for their souls, self-humiliation, cries for mercy, persevering prayer until God gave them relief, so that the people who were converted lived to show they were converted. And the life of Mid Wales and South Wales began to be changed remarkably. This wasn't any Toronto blessing convulsing people with laughter. This made people weep over their sins. What was it that accounted for such blessing? Well, he was a Welshman. He had what you find in Welsh people, that gift that it is impossible to define, of moving the heart. But it wasn't just that, because there were many Welsh preachers. But Rowlands seemed to stand above them all. His ministry filled his contemporaries with an awe. They viewed him as a man sent from God. Certain things were noticeable. He had a powerful mind. His perception of the great truths of God was such that divine spiritual truths were as real to him as though he could see them before his eyes. And he was able to convey this to the simplest of listeners. His people were simple people. They weren't clever people. He could do it in illustration from simple things of life. Wherever he went, walking, riding, conversing, his mind took in incidents and he used them to illustrate the truths of the gospel. Speaking of the providence of God and how to us it seems crooked, but in God's eyes it is all clear and plain. He likened it to a stick put in water, and as we look at it we see the stick bent. But take the stick out and it's straight. And so, he said, is God's providence. To us it's bent, but God sees it straight. This kind of thing. He had a strong memory. He was an able scholar. He knew Greek and Hebrew, but he knew his Bible, so that he rarely had to refer to it for a text. He almost knew his Bible off by heart. He was well read in the Puritans. His favorite writer was Gurnall, Complete Armor. But he was well read in all the Puritans. He was sound in doctrine, a sound Calvinist. He stayed and kept the association sound all his life. He had intense feeling. They said he possessed as much animal spirits as there were enough for half a dozen men. This was his natural makeup, but it acted as wings to his soul. What his mind saw, his heart felt powerfully, and yet his feelings were under perfect control, so that if he were preaching and he were weeping, as he often did, as he felt the truth of the gospel, his voice didn't break. But even though tears were streaming down his face, his voice remained clear and powerful. He was in total control of his feelings. Sometimes his feelings overpowered him. On one occasion, praying before preaching, he dwelt in his prayer on the sufferings of Christ. And in his prayer he seemed to pause. O empty veins, O pale countenance. And the sight of the crucified Saviour was so much that he fainted in the pulpit, but quickly recovered and went on to preach with astonishing energy and power. He had that combination of clear understanding and tremendous feeling, so that when he spoke the truth, it came with tremendous power to his hearers. And he had a penetrating and a melting voice. There was nothing harsh. He never shouted. Even at his loudest, and he could be heard among 5,000 people, yet it was still that tender, affectionate, melting voice, wooing and persuading people to come to Christ. He was a rare instrument. God had combined in him qualities that make up a preacher rarely found in any other. He had Whitfield's energy, eloquence, but he had far greater depth and far greater theology than Whitfield, though the two were thought highly of each other. But it's thought that he was, if you like, the far sounder and greater theologian than Whitfield. His converts proved the reality of his work. Many, many years after his death, Rowland Hill speaks of a meeting of ministers, and an old man, nearly 100, got up from the back, and he said, "Brethren, I heard Daniel Rowlands. I heard him once say, 'Except your consciences be cleansed by the blood of Christ, you must all perish in the eternal fires.' And that message had stayed with that man 25 years after Daniel Rowland's death. Above all, his preaching was on Christ. Christ, his blood, his sacrifice, his righteousness, his patience, his saving grace, his coming again and his kingdom. It was Christ that he put before his people." Yes, he was an outstanding preacher, but he was an outstanding man. God balanced the tremendous gifts with tremendous suffering. His trials, his persecutions I've spoken about. In them all, he showed the courage of a lion. Nothing made him afraid. Sadly, he experienced differences with those he loved. Howell Harris, for 13 years, wandered into some error, despite the pleadings of Rowlands and Whitfield. But he came back, and the breach was healed, and blessing was restored. He had private domestic troubles. I'm so glad they are totally unknown. None of the writers of that day would refer to them. How different from today. He had a wife and 7 surviving children, but virtually nothing is known about them apart from the one who continued in the ministry. What his trials were, we don't know, except that till the end of his life he had bitter domestic trial. God kept him low. Above all, he had a tremendous humility. He was so conscious of his own unworthiness that at times he had almost to be made to go in the pulpit. So reluctant was he to preach because of his felt unworthiness as a sinner. And he had a love for souls. On one occasion, riding with a friend out of the valley where Llangeitho was, as they reached the edge of the hills, he looked back over that valley and spoke of the wickedness of its people. And as he spoke, he wept. He broke down with weeping as he thought of those people perishing, because they rejected the gospel. He had a love for souls. And he had a life of self-denial. He was offered by John Thornton, a wealthy, godly philanthropist in London, a comfortable living in Pembrokeshire in exchange for his £10 a year. He was inclined to take it. It would give him freedom to preach without persecution. But when his congregation heard, they gathered around his house weeping in hundreds and thousands, begging him not to go. It said of one dear old soul, she said to him, "Where will Mary get her bread from if you go?" He stayed. You see, this was Daniel Rowlands. God owned him and blessed him. Well, he died. He had prayed that he might go direct from his work to his everlasting rest. God gave him his faculties, his power in preaching, till the end of his life. He preached on the Sabbath. On the Saturday morning, he was in heaven. He had spoken about his death in his last two Sabbath sermons. "I'm almost leaving you. I'm not tired of my work, but I'm tired in it. I've no more to state by way of acceptance with God than I've always said. I die as a poor sinner, depending fully and entirely on a crucified Saviour." He was buried, and all Wales went into mourning. They drove him out of the church, but they couldn't keep his body out of the churchyard, and it was buried at the east end of the church. Whether it's where the slab is today, I don't know. But he was buried there. Amazingly, nothing was written about him. His contemporaries, even men like Thomas Charles, felt utterly incapable of writing adequately about Daniel Rowlands. The unanimous verdict was, unless you heard him, you cannot possibly imagine the majesty of his preaching. Thomas Charles wrote to a friend, encouraging him to write. All the material that they gathered together was sent to the Countess of Huntingdon so that it could be put together. She died. It was lost. And so, apart from two short little memoirs, little is known about Daniel Rowland. Heaven has it all. A great man, one of the greatest ever. I don't know how that should affect us, because we are not great, we're little people. But you see, he had helpers. I think we can remember certain things. It was God who sent Daniel Rowland, because it needed Daniel Rowland to break through the wickedness of that time. God may not intend to do that in our time, but he still needs men and women and boys and girls. They said of him that he was an apostolic man. He lived almost unconnected with the world. His manner of life carried the mind back many, many centuries to New Testament times. He was a New Testament Christian. We must remember that gifts are given by God. The people of his day valued that gift. The tendency in our day is to despise gift, because we're all equal and anybody can do it. But when you see a work like this, you suddenly realize that God must give gifts. And it is the duty of every church to value and honor the gifts given, and to pray that God will raise up gifts for the times that lie ahead. But we must also remember, too, that he had many, many co-workers and helpers who were lesser people, who loved to work with him. And there's nothing in the world for a boy or a girl to be ambitious about than to be ambitious to be a servant of Jesus Christ. To serve Jesus Christ is the highest honor in the world. And so when you think of the great men like Daniel Rowlands, it makes us long that you and I, each of us, could fill our little lives with a little of that kind of dedication. Bless, Lord, to our hearts what we have heard about. We thank thee for thy work of grace in others long ago. O Lord, how we long that that work of thine in our hearts might be of the same kind. O, make us more devoted to thee, we ask thee. And now as we go home, bless us. Bless those we love. Bless this church, remembering especially any who are in trial or difficulty. Be with us graciously, for the Lord Jesus Christ's sake. Amen.